45 minutes. We will make it 45 minutes. Yes, 45. We'll be able to do minimum of 15 program. Yeah. Okay. Can we take our seat, colleagues? Over to Didi. Yeah.
Thank
you. Must also indicate that the members received the presentation, so they would have gone through the normal procedure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I will do a summary version, so I will not go in detail through every slide to try to make up some time, so there is time, Chair, for discussion. I'll try and make it about 10 minutes max for presentation. The first presentation will focus on the 20th Conference of the Parties under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Lima negotiations taking place at the end of the year. I'll really just give you an update on the negotiations so far and South Africa's broad position, particularly on political issues, some of the political issues. In terms of the progress in Durban. It's always useful just to start from where Durban was, which set up a negotiation process, four-year process, to reach agreement in 2015 on a new legal agreement which would deal with global emissions after 2020, but which would also deal with the lack of ambition pre-2020. Now, leading up to the 2015 new legal agreement, there have been three COPs, one in Doha, which took very critical decisions, for example, on the Second Amendment to the Kyoto Protocol, and on setting the agenda, the multi-year plan for this negotiation process of 4 years. There was the session in Warsaw, which established the which set the actual decisions that need to be taken in at Lima and in the lead up to Paris in 2015. It also established an important international mechanism to deal with loss and damage, and that is the impact and the loss and the damage associated with climate change events. And importantly, it advanced the process of capitalizing the Green Climate Fund. So these were very important steps. All of these are building blocks leading up to Lima and Paris. So there you can see how each of the COPs builds on each other, from Durban to Doha to Warsaw in 2013 and moving then into 2014 and the Lima negotiations. It's useful, Honourable Chair, to have this context and see how momentum is building, because it really provides the focus and the approach, South Africa's approach going into the Lima negotiations. There has been a lot of work already done, negotiating work already done this year. There was a negotiation in March. There was a follow-up negotiation in Germany and a ministerial session in June, in fact, in which the focus was on trying to raise a level of ambition by developed countries. The June session was not successful in that, but some progress was in fact made in providing the basis for coming up with a text that will be the negotiating text going into 2015 in Paris. We've just returned only 2 weeks ago from the negotiations in October, and that also took us some way to ensure that we have an outcome in Lima which deals with key setting the elements of the new legal agreement, and most importantly the minimum information and the process for establishing the nationally determined contributions. Now, the nationally determined contributions, Honourable Chair, are what countries are expected to contribute to reducing, to the global process of reducing emissions and keeping the temperature rise below an increase of 2 degrees. Each country is expected to indicate what they will be doing to reduce emissions and what they will be doing to adapt to the impacts of climate change, and I'll talk a little bit later about South Africa's process in that respect. You will recall that the United Nations Secretary General hosted a climate summit on the 23rd of September, that was in the margins of UNGO, the United Nations General Assembly. It was an important session in that it really focused on building a political momentum, and leaders committed there to to really be serious about completing the work in Paris on a new league agreement, to arrive at a first draft of the agreement in Lima, and for countries to submit these nationally determined contributions. There were also a lot of pledges and action platforms that were negotiated prior to the UNFG summit, and overall I think our sense from a South African perspective was it was a very good momentum builder, political momentum builder, and bodes well for the Lima negotiations. Just, Honourable Chair, a few words on the political dynamics and therefore the key political issues that we need to be really focusing on in Lima and next year during the negotiations. The major issue is this question of differentiation of responsibilities, an outcome that is equitable, that is fair, and how to build that fairness into the new legal agreement. There's increasing pressure, you can see on the left-hand side, increasing pressure on the so-called middle-income and emerging countries to take on a greater responsibility, in particular in respect of emission reductions, and of course that refers to China, India, Brazil, and South Africa is in that mix there. The other issue in respect of the political dynamic is that developed countries are refusing and are very clear that they are not able to go ahead with this, referred to as a binary distinction between the responsibilities of developed on the one hand and the responsibilities of developing countries on the other hand. So we've got to find a landing zone that finds a way of ensuring that it is equitable as an outcome, but takes us some way further than what the current United Nations Framework Convention does. Of course, any attempts to reclassify countries pose a challenge for the traditional north-south groupings, and also this issue of developed versus developing country responsibilities is not restricted to the climate change context. It has implications right across the board, across many of the economic multilateral agreements, social multilateral agreements, etc. Political dynamics, I'm just going to raise a couple of issues. Differentiation I've spoken to. The length of the commitment period is a key issue, 2020 to 2025 or longer than that. Basically what's been established is a system, a global system of reducing emissions and slowly building resilience, and it's relevant to South Africa because we are in the process of setting our own national system for reducing emissions in relation to our peak plateau and decline, and also building our resilience and being able to adapt to the impact. The question around commitments, there are two proposals and how to deal with the commitments, country commitments or nationally determined contributions. South Africa's view and developing countries' view is that as countries make their commitments in respect of reducing their emissions, there has to be an assessment, an ex-ante, an upfront assessment that comes to a conclusion as to whether the collective of all of these commitments is sufficient, is adequate for holding the global temperature below 2 degrees. That's a developing country perspective. You will find that another perspective from the USA, for example, would be that it's not about checking adequacy, and certainly countries cannot be asked to increase their nationally determined contributions. It's rather just a process of transparency and being able to compare apples to apples. The other question, big question in Lima, is whether the nationally determined contributions are focusing only on emission reductions or whether it's also focusing on adaptation, finance, technology. The South African view is that these nationally determined contributions have to address the widest scope. It's got to address adaptation, capacity building, transparency right across the board, because you cannot deal with mitigation and adaptation in isolation. The less the global emission reduction, the greater the impact, and therefore the greater the capacity needed to build resilience. What will be the legal form? This is a very, very critical issue, and what will be the elements of the agreement? This is the substance of the negotiation in Lima. And in terms of competing architecture paradigms, you'll see there's the top-down on your left-hand side and the bottom-up style on your right-hand side. top-down being the legal form is based on multilateral commitments with inclusive and equitable participation. It must be internationally legally binding. There must be common multilaterally agreed rules. And the level of ambition must be informed by science. So that is the approach that South Africa is adopting. That is the approach that we agreed broadly in Durban. Although I think what was really critical about the Durban outcome was that it started finding the middle zone between that top-down and bottom-up. The bottom-up style is driven by pledge and review system. It is self-determined. Countries determine their own targets. There are domestically legal commitments, domestically determined rules, and in essence, we completely lose the multilateral global agreement approach. So this would be not a South African position at all, but the solution will be somewhere in between the two. Chair, I'm going to, I think, skip some of the details around the emerging architecture. Honourable Members, it's in the presentation, and I would certainly be able to respond to any further questions. But in the interest of time, I have to also say on institutional linkages, critical thing is to make the links between the many international structures, financing structures, technology structures, adaptation structures, even the registry. The Green Climate Fund there is absolutely essential, and it's got to be linked with the other convention financing mechanism. I think, Honourable Member, just to say that South Africa will be taking on the chair of the Group of 27 in China as of January next year. It is Africa's turn, and through a broader process that of which the climate change negotiations is only one small part, and that process was driven by the Department of International Relations. It was agreed that South Africa will take that responsibility for the Africa Group. And Africa also has the responsibility of co-chairing the negotiating forum, which is an ad hoc working group on the Durban platform. That's the AP. So it's a big responsibility for the Africa Group. It places South Africa and Africa in quite a strategic position in the negotiations. It is not going to be an easy chairing of the Group of 77. The group is quite fragmented, very fragmented in fact, and is only able to cohere around the high-level principal issues without being able to find a common agreement on many of the details. So it will be a tough job for South Africa to do that co-chairing. In terms of the Africa Group and co-chairing of the AP, that one is still taking place. That discussion is still taking place. I'm sure by Lima we'll have a full nomination. The critical thing, though, for South Africa to watch in the negotiations is that the many streams of negotiations, and there are at least six streams of negotiations, that we are able to prioritize the critical issues across those streams of negotiations to maneuver the 2015 agreement into place. So it's a complex exercise. We also need to watch some of the real critical issues for South Africa, for example, the adaptation agenda. We do not want to backslide on the adaptation agenda. We do not want to backslide on the loss and damage agenda. We want a full operationalization of the Green Climate Fund, and we must have a draft elements of the negotiation text out of Lima. Consultation process. The South African delegation consists of representation from across key sector departments. Honourable Members will be joining us. There's representation from provinces, there's representation from key stakeholder groupings. The position is consulted quite widely. The Minister convened a stakeholder consultation session with a wide range of stakeholders on the 17th of October, and we'll have a follow-up at the National Climate Change Response Conference and Dialogue between the 10th to the 16th of November, and I think the final point is that it has gone through the various stages. Thank you, Chair. That's the first point. Shall I keep moving?
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine was just to suggest that in order to be more effective, maybe the G77 in mainland China, why don't we piggyback on the current relationship we have with the BRICS? So that at that level you have an agreement at BRICS level, then you easily influence and bargain at the negotiation table. I know it's late, but do consider that, especially that we are involved in building the economies of this bloc. So it would be good to lead by example.
Thank you, Honorable Louis of the Portfolio Committee. Honorable Mark.
Thanks, issues. One regards the approaches to the top bottom approach versus the bottom approach. The multilateralism versus unilateralism and all of those other principles in there. Where we are on multilateralism, West Africa prefers to go and agree with us. Do we know who else in terms of countries are so that we know we are likely to succeed in that regard in terms of lobbying and all of that? And on that second, the sharing of G77 and possibly Africa's responsibility on the ADP. I know all of that goes with post-funding or budget in that regard. It's not an easy issue just of the issues of fragmentation and so on, but it also goes with the responsibilities, whether you end its responsibility or a country that chairs takes responsibility in terms of that, and whether we are ready for South Africa for that. And the last one, some of the positions we may somewhat forget them. I would prefer a situation where, again, we do have those. So the members who will accompany you to the conference or this event, at least know that on this area, this is what is the position of South Africa on this aspect. This is some kind of a spreadsheet that clarifies these issues so that we don't have members who may sleep in some of those issues simply because they have to rely on their memories and so on and so on. Yeah.
Thanks. Honorable Stan. My leader, is your hand up? Okay. Honorable Stan.
Thank you, Chair. I also note the two approaches to the negotiation, the top-down versus the bottom-up, and I'm glad that we are moving towards the third option, which, as I see it, should have minimum standards implemented for all countries based on scientific evidence plus the pledges of countries who can do more, etc., to do so. I also know that South Africa as a developing country is commended for their efforts and the progress that they are making in moving towards achieving our targets. But one thing that concerns me, and I understand to a certain extent the frustration or the anger that developed countries might have, that developing countries can get away with murder, specifically China. Because whilst we are taking a considered approach to mitigating climate change, they saying to hell with it, our people are more important and we are going driving economy. So now I see
South Africa and China working towards 2015 or something like that. Is it 2015? Yeah, China in 2015. And I want to know what is our stance with other developing countries who are starting global efforts to reduce global emissions and reduce the temperature by 2 degrees. Because with the enormity of China's economy and size, I mean, you know, we can have as many South Africans trying to dip, promise to do our job, and it's just going to be undone by a bully. So what is our position there?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. The question about BASIC, Honourable Holomis, absolutely. Well, in the climate change negotiations, it's not referred to as BRICS, but BASIC, because Russia actually falls under the developed country bloc in these negotiations. So there was a BASIC ministerial meeting convened by Minister Molewa last month on the 19th and 10th of October, where the positions of BASIC countries that do cohere were outlined in the BASIC statement. And certainly that is a really key foundation and support for South Africa in carrying the group of 77. However, having said that, there are quite big differences in some areas of the positions, whether it's whether it's Brazil's position, India's position, China's position on a on a number of issues. So our areas of where there is coherence, we certainly use that, and the areas where there are differences, we work around those. Remember, the BASIC is in fact not a negotiation block; it's simply a coordination forum more than anything. In respect of the top-down, bottom-up, and who else is in that mix? The top-down. Who else is in the mix of promoting or starting from the starting point of having a top-down approach? Broadly, the group of 77, the developing country bloc. And that includes obviously the Africa group, and then the European Union is part of that. It is, however, quite complex in the sense that this question of equity and what constitutes an equitable outcome, and who contributes what, and who is responsible for ensuring that the low level of emission pre-2020 is addressed, is at the heart of this. So the European Union, for example, while they are certainly driving a multilateral approach and a multilateral outcome, they are also pushing for a shift in this question of the binary division between developed and developing countries. They want a shift which demonstrates that there are developing countries that are now, such as China, followed quite closely by a number of the other big developing countries that are increasingly emitting, becoming the biggest emitters. So that is why it's finding that midway between the top-down and the bottom-up approach is the challenge. And what Durban outlined is a framework which is a multilateral framework, in which we agree the rules, multilaterally agreed rules, we agree the multilateral basis for reporting, and there has to be support, finance support, from developed countries to developing countries, yet it makes space for bottom-up pledging, what is domestically determined, leads the way. That was the Durban framing of what is the midway possible compromise outcome. Finance, as you say, is absolutely at the heart of it. It's about building trust, and there have been a number of finance commitments, multilaterally agreed finance commitments, for example, $100 billion by 2020, is the developed country support for developing country action, which is not at, I mean, those commitments have not been met. And that is a really sore point with many of the developing countries. So we need a good finance outcome. We need a clear trajectory towards the 100 billion and post the 100 billion. We need good capitalization of the Green Climate Fund. We need a clear frame of a finance outcome within the 2015 agreement. In respect of, I think, the question on who actually finances South Africa as being the G77 chair, well, it's a national responsibility. Mostly the Group of 77 chairing will be the responsibility of the Department of International Relations, and they will need to fund. We do get some small support, but not much, to undertake that responsibility, but we need to be gearing up. At G77 chairing responsibility place, a big additional, perhaps burden is too strong a word, but additional role for South Africa means that we have to gear up our national delegation to deal with that. In terms of the key messages, absolutely, and what the South African position would be, what we do each year is develop a set of key messages which guide the delegation on in each of the negotiation processes. This is South Africa's position. This is where we could possibly fall back to. That would not be within the key messages, but that would be part of the negotiation strategy, but a set of key messages that guide the entire delegation in their negotiation. In terms of the question about China, China is actually a very interesting country. Last year they published their 12-5-year plan, which sets out their plans in respect of reducing emissions and adapting. Do not underestimate the work that China is doing. Of course, they have a similar challenge as us in terms of a growing economy based on a coal electricity system, coal-based generation of electricity, and they are building coal-based power stations quite fast. But at the same time, China actually is putting a lot of energy into reducing their emissions, and we need to watch China from a trade perspective and a competition perspective. At the same time, your point, I think, really is that it requires a global agreement. It doesn't help if South Africa reduces its emissions when other countries, bigger countries that are emitting far more than South Africa, do not also reduce their emissions. So it goes back to the fact that the multilateral rules to guide the contributions and a multilateral legal agreement.
Thank you, Chair. Just to also reinforce the responses from Judy, certainly just on the challenge aspect, I think there is a burden, but there is also a strategic positioning that South Africa would have in respect of strengthening the regional policy to be more aligned and ensure that the Durban outcome is carried through and we are able to then influence the Paris meeting or conference in a year's time. So I think that's the aspect, and therefore the cost that was associated with that coordination compared to what we can achieve, I think then they become minimal. Secondly, I think Honorable Member Sender, on this matter of China, the difficulty that the negotiations have been battling with over the years has been the fact that developed countries have grown at the back of carbon intensity. And the problem of warming, or at least climate change, is more a cumulative problem. It's not because of today's emissions. It's more based on the years of aging, and that is scientifically based, and therefore it becomes difficult when you have countries like the US and other developed countries that of the North that are not at least sharing and leading in terms of Abishin currently. And that is that was an issue that almost collapsed Durban, and therefore at this point we're saying that there is willingness from developing countries to contribute a fair share of their responsibility. And I think the formula in the multilateral framework would then seem to be really concerned to the final outcomes of Paris. So at this point in time, in South Africa, we cannot tap on the finger on China. Diplomatically, we're not in a position to do that. No, even when we then talk as a bloc, China is part of G77, and basically we then have to influence them in that role as part of the group, the Africa and G77 grouping. So in a sense, we need to continue as more than developing economies to play a leadership role in our context. And I think in that sense, there are areas where we are divergent with China, as Judy was saying, but there are also some areas where we are convergent. And I think that's basically more is the spirit of the position.
Okay, thanks, Gizzy. We'll give the members the opportunity to pose their questions. As we approach Lima, there are encouraging headlines that, for example, the UN is being asked for climate change, and also that Peru is a pre-destination for Paris. Now, if you go further, you'll see that 800 scientists have made their own applications and doing a compelling case why we should reach sufficient consensus. What I want to know from our negotiators, you must know that the DGC is one of the negotiators there. To what extent are the developed countries taking this message serious in terms of subsiding their selfish intentions so that we reach sufficient consensus? Because according to development, if Lima fails, then automatically Paris fails 2050. I've got two questions that I want to pose now. One is, to what extent have leaders promoted themselves to finalize a meaningful universal new agreement under COP21 in Paris in 2015, among other things? The question will be, how have they promoted themselves? Have they promoted themselves in your discussions verbally, or in writing, or through a commitment sign? I just want to check and clarify on that aspect. The last one will be, in terms of slide 9, there are two commitment periods, proposed 2020, 2025, 2030. What is our position, and what is the rationale for our position? What then do we comment on 2100? What is our comment on we have not reached that stage? Because I've gone through some of the UN positions, documents, to talk about 2100. Those are the aspects that I wanted to be clarified on. But I think I agree, DG, that and the DG, that for us as South Africa and as Africa group to share, it's a very strategic position which we must use to leverage our position. Those will be my questions and comments. We'll take a next round. Can you please just clarify those? Thanks, DG.
Thank you, Chair. The question on the science is important because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just on Sunday morning, I think, in the early hours, concluded the negotiations on the final summary of the three working groups under the Intergovernmental Panel. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel has a working group on the science, has a working group on the impact of climate change, and has a working group on reducing emissions. And the meeting last week pulled all of the findings together from these 800 scientists and produced a summary for policymakers. And it's a useful document to have a look at. It's quite a long document. It's backed by thousands of pages of science behind it. Thank you. Thank you. To be precise, 5,000 pages. Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair. And this report is produced. This is the fifth assessment report of the IPCC. It takes place every 5 years. This is the fifth one. And increasingly, that science is demonstrating with certainty not only that climate change is caused by anthropogenic human causes, human reasons, emissions of greenhouse gases. It's also demonstrating with scientific background the kinds of impacts that can be expected in African continent, for example, and the kind of impact in respect of food security that will be affected, water security, health security, human settlement security. This is an important piece of information brought into the negotiation, because these negotiations are the exact example of negotiations where science meets policy, science meets planning, science meets implementation at a global, regional, and national level. So that assessment report influences constructively and positively these negotiations. But unfortunately, the negotiations still continue. The negotiations are not required to take cognizance of different parts of the assessment report. But the Africa Group, for example, will use the outcome of the Working Group 2 on impact and adaptation very, very strongly to demonstrate the kind of impacts that Africa can expect, and therefore the implications, the kind of finance that is required in the short, medium, and long term to enable African countries or other developing countries to build resilience and adapt to the impact of climate change. Similarly, on emission reductions and the fact that emissions are simply not being reduced, global emissions are simply not being reduced fast enough to keep the global temperature below that 2 degrees increase, which then means that small island developing states are at certain risk of flooding, coastal cities are at certain risk of flooding, and it once again comes back to this implication in respect of the kind of adaptation and the kind of negotiation position that we need to take on the emission reduction commitments that need to be made across the board, taking into account the DG's reminder that the equity and common but differentiated responsibility is founded upon the fact that developed countries have grown and have built their economies on the back of a carbonized world. On the question of Honourable Chair, yes, please.
Okay, let me just add to Judy's. The other question was what would be the demonstration of the leadership and commitment. I think currently there is no written commitment, but Judy in the presentation earlier on spoke about the meeting that was convened by the UN Secretary General at the margins of the heads of state and government council in September, which itself had a statement about the commitment for to finalize a meaningful and a universal agreement on under the UNFCCC by Paris, and that countries are encouraged to submit their pledges or at least their indications of what they call the intended national intended contributions before Paris. So I think we will then confirm that the countries, especially say in Africa or developing countries, are committed to arriving at an agreement in terms through those intentions. If they've tabled them prior, then we may be able to gauge at this point in time. I think we just take it from the spirit of the convention that all parties are committed to arriving at an agreement. We don't have a written commitments. No pledges.
Thank you. To your last point about the 2020 versus 2025 or 2030 and the time frame of the commitment period. For South Africa, at this stage, we are not too, we can go both ways for 2025 or 2030, because the way we're setting up our national system is that we would have 5-year commitment periods, and the first 5-year commitment period would start on the 1st of January 2016, and that leads us into the next presentation about our mitigation approach. So it would be from 2016 to the end of 2020, 2021 to the end of 2025, 2025 to the end of 2030. And our plateau period is from 2025 to 2035. So our broad approach is that we need a robust global system. So preferably we would want a 2030 outcome, because that gives the advantage of a longer time period without having to renegotiate. But we can be flexible on this particular issue.
We will take the next brief presentation. Over to you, Judy. Some questions that you wanted to follow up, I request that you make a note, give them to the PDG, submit them in writing, and then they can be responded to, so that we must cover all the other topics that are supposed to be presented. Over to you, Judy.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. This will once again be quite quick. This is the base, the foundation work that is being done currently to establish South Africa's system for reducing emissions. This work obviously has partner work around what needs to be done to adapt within South Africa, within sectors and across national, provincial and local to adapt to the impact of climate change. So this is only the one side of the coin, focusing on emission reduction. I'll just refer to the mitigation potential analysis work that has been done, the further emission reduction work that is underway also by other sectoral departments, the work to establish South Africa's emission reduction outcomes and carbon budgets to start the process of reducing South Africa's emissions. At the end of last year, through a very consultative process with in business and industry, very deeply involved in the process, as well as non-government organizations and other sector departments leading the work, we undertook the mitigation potential analysis, and this did four things. It projected South Africa's emissions into the future. So to have an assessment also building on the work that was done and the long-term mitigation scenarios in 2008, to have a good understanding of where South Africa's emissions will be going into the future, into the short, medium and long term, up to 2050, what we can expect with and without emission reductions. We then identified and analyzed the emission reduction opportunities. Now, this is a wide range of mitigation opportunities, technologies across different sectors, and presented these technologies on what is referred to as an marginal abatement cost curve, which basically, in simple language, talking English, simply shows these technologies on a graph with those technologies that are able to reduce the greatest amount of emissions at the least cost. And there's one or two examples that we'll show. It then assessed the socioeconomic and environmental impacts and developed the first part on emission reduction pathways. Now, these emission reduction pathways only focus on what is technically possible, what from a technological perspective is possible. And I emphasize that because the next piece of work which we're currently doing is to build in what the instruments are, finance instruments such as the carbon tax, such as energy efficiency standards, such as technology standards. The carbon tax is a critical instrument for also bringing emissions down. We worked in five sectors, as you can see, the energy sector, industry sector, transport sector, waste sector, and the last one is agriculture, forestry, and land use. Just to say that the relevant sector departments led this work, so the Department of Energy, led the work on the energy subsectors. DPI led on industry, Department of Transport and Transport, etc. DIA led on waste, and Department of Agriculture led on the agriculture, forestry, and land use. And what I mean by leading, it was to facilitate that engagement with industry. Industry was is a critical partner here, because it's industry that are able to identify the kind of technologies that are being used currently, the kind of technologies that they believe can be used in the medium and long term. I'll show you one or two examples, one from the commercial building sector and one from road transport, just to give you a sense of what the kind of outcome that this was produced. These reports are currently being laid out and printed and will be available for members to show each of those subsectors and the kind of technologies we're talking about. So in commercial buildings, for example, there, and this is where we come to the marginal abatement cost curve, the physical axis is the axis that shows the cost. And in this instance, all of those mitigation opportunities have no cost or savings. Low cost, no cost or savings. Zero is the horizontal line. And the mitigation technologies that you can see there are the use of efficient lighting, the use of energy efficient appliances, the use of emission sensitive heat and air cooling systems, the use of heat pumps, particular types of heat pumps that reduce emissions. The major one, the blue one, is passive building. Improved thermal design in new buildings, and that shows, that blue line there shows you the maximum amount of emission reductions. That's why that line is so wide, and with absolutely clear cost savings and there you can see R1,000 per ton cost savings, and this basically is telling us that if we build our buildings with good thermal design, pressing in the right direction, the right kind of material for the roofing, which is then warm in winter and cool in summer without additional heating, you save incredible tonnages of emissions and money. The road transport example, you'll see that one is above the line, so these examples of mitigation opportunities do have cost implications. The green bar refers to improved efficiency of vehicles. The blue bar refers to use of alternative fuels in petrol vehicles. The lighter blue version is alternative fuel in diesel vehicles. So you can see, in terms of the technology and the mitigation opportunities, once again, the cost indications and the amount of emissions that can be reduced. This work was done for 2020, 2030, and 2050. And it's interesting to note when you track between 2020 and 2050, for example, a shift of road to rail has high cost in 2020 because we've got to build the infrastructure, but by 2050 has major cost savings because by that time the infrastructure is built and freight is now being moved by rail, which has major emission reductions. This pulls all together and shows that from a national perspective, if you put all of these emission reduction opportunities together, 57.8% of those can be achieved with a negative cost, in other words, with a saving. So on the left-hand side, all the dark blue ones are savings, whereas on the right-hand side are the measures that have cost implications. There is further work that is being done. We're working with the Department of Science and Technology to do a mitigation technology plan, which for all of these key technologies identifies what enabling environment needs to be in place and what partnerships need to be in place to ensure that South Africa can access the technologies that are needed in the short, medium, and long term. Department of Economic Development is working with us on the National Employment Vulnerability Assessment, and this is identifying which sectors there may be employment vulnerability because those sectors are high carbon sectors and could become legacy sectors with the shift to low carbon. We're working with DOE to integrate the resource planning process, the IRP planning process, with the emissions reduction planning process. We're working with DOE and SUNEDI around CCS, which is a major technology to take out emissions from our largely coal-based, at the moment, energy system. Honourable members, the next step is setting the South Africa's emission reduction outcomes per sector, identifying what is achievable per sector, setting the tonnage per sector and subsector, and then allocating those emission reduction outcomes at a sector level, at subsector level, and ultimately in a second bullet, companies would, the highest emitting companies would take carbon budgets. This means that there is an allocation, carbon allocation over a 5-year period, and companies would need to stay below that allocation. The carbon tax would be used as an instrument to support compliance with that carbon budget, but the carbon tax is not the only instrument that government instruments that would be available for companies to keep their emissions, to get their emissions going down. Companies will be required to submit mitigation plans and ultimately would be required through a set of regulations, greenhouse gas reporting regulations, to report on their achievements in respect of reducing emissions. Three more slides, honourable members. This one shows you South Africa's peak, plateau, and decline. The yellow line in the middle is the heat factor decline trajectory that is set out in the policy. The bottom line and the top line gives South Africa a range. It gives flexibility for South Africa to work within the range, an upper range and a lower range. You'll see there on the bottom axis, from 2010 all the way up to 2025, our emissions do increase. So this shows that South Africa's economy is growing. It shows that South Africa's emissions will continue to grow until 2025, but by then, from now until 2025, we have to build in the necessary capacity and the necessary system to enable our emissions to plateau. That means that our emissions no longer grow, but they are starting to even out, so that by 2035, South Africa's emissions start actually declining in absolute terms. I think I've dealt with that. The alignment of systems, I've already mentioned the work that is being done with Treasury to make sure that the emission reduction work is aligned with the carbon tax and that the carbon tax is used as, which it basically means that the carbon tax will apply to emissions that are above a threshold. So companies can emit up to a particular threshold. Above that threshold, the carbon tax will apply. So companies would only be taxed on those emissions above their budget. We're also working with the Department of Energy to finalize a reporting system in which we are able to use the data that the Department of Energy is collecting around energy and energy use and efficiency. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. You've done justice to the level of mitigation potential emission reduction. It's quite a technical subject matter for scientists and so. Can I get input? Honorable Stada, and then Honorable Witt, Honorable Kubera.
Thank you, Chief. These questions are quite simple. I just wanted to find out the the marginal abatement cost curve that is shown on page 6. It shows, you know, the various savings versus costs, etc. I wanted to find out if those costs are related to loss in revenue
or costs in terms of putting in infrastructure or both. I just wanted to see how that was calculated. I also want to find out examples or instances of how governments, the broader general departments, whether it's energy or human settlement, etc., have looked at this abatement cost curve and how they, which strategies they are choosing to implement. Is there anything that you can update us with there? And then I just wanted on the national benchmark range, I want to find on page 7, I just wanted to find out at what percentage of economic growth, annual growth, was that calculated at? Because I see it taking us to 2025. I'm very interested to see what our projected economic growth will be, because, of course, you know, we might have different forecasts there, and we can just see, you know, adjust it accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you. Over to you, Whip of the Portfolio Committee, Honorable Makube.
Thanks. Just to say that when you emphasize the fact that this presentation is highly technical, you are probably not saying we can't rise to the occasion. I don't want to regret because some intimidation. I want us to try and raise just three quick ones. Firstly, just to verify with the department whether they did make an input to the existing energy efficiency building regulations. And this is not what would have been the issue. And you'll bear with me, sir. I have to move out slightly. In the event I raise something which was covered, just the fact that I might have been but the second, it's in terms of what could be the commencement period for the industry to begin with the with submitting mitigation plans. You said they should be able to submit those plans. But when are they supposed to do that? Just for us to know and we're able to hold you to account on it. And the other reference to carbon tax. In as much as other countries may be abandoning that, we're still using that ourselves as the policy instrument to guide this mitigation as well. But what is the state of readiness in terms of implementing that carbon tax policy? Are we there? We can make projections and so on, but if we are not sure of our capacity to enforce that, that will be may not be realized. Just for you to share with us one more slide. Thanks.
On page 2, the transport, road transport, I just want to take DG and DDG. While we understand this is the core mandate of DOT, Department of Transport, but the whole vision of migration of freight and cargo from road to rail to minimize the impact on infrastructure. To what extent is DIA cooperating with their technical skills and scientific skills around this aspect in assisting the DOT to analyze the migration of freight from road to rail? That is the only one. I'm covered with the others. Thanks. Over to the DG and the DDG. First the DDG, then the DG. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Member. In terms of, I hope I got it all in order. What growth rate was used? It was we were advised by Treasury to take an average growth rate of 4.2%. But we did a sensitivity analysis. So we did an upper and a lower. So the upper went as far as 6% and the lower went down to 2% growth. So that presents a graph, and I can make that graph available to you, that demonstrates emissions growth under those different scenarios.
incorporating that sensitivity, recognizing that it is an inexact science in the sense that this is about predictions, estimates, but we were guided by Treasury in that respect. On examples of what government is doing, the Department of Public Works, the Department of Energy, and our department are working together with a memorandum of understanding on bringing energy efficiency into public buildings. It's being led by the Department of Public Works and supported by ourselves and Department of Energy. We have just submitted a quite major request for funding from the department, the German Department of Environment, which has indicated positively that they would be providing additional support, and this is moving towards quite a massive program. In addition, what the white paper, the policy on climate change, makes provision for is a set of national flagships. And so there's a flagship on transport, for example, there's a flagship on energy efficiency, on renewable energy, and on water, on public works, etc. And the thinking behind and the rationale behind these flagships is that there is work already underway by government, but that work needs to be scaled up. And the scaling up actually requires cross-sectoral coordination across departments. And in addition, the scaling up in most instances will require a coordination around mobilizing resources, and it will require coordination around making sure that the right technology is in place at the right time, and also requires institutional and policy coordination. So the flagship program, the climate change flagship program, once again has the lead departments. The Department of Transport would be leading on their transport flagship, which is included. It's their multi-year strategy on green transport, which is included in the medium-term strategic framework guided by the National Development Plan. Department of Energy has included their energy efficiency flagship also in the medium-term strategic framework. Similarly, their renewable energy. So there's a series of programs which are being led by sector departments which have as their outcome not only reduction of emissions, but also building the infrastructure for renewable energy, building our capacity to enhance energy efficiency, building our transport infrastructure, building our capacity to, over the short, medium, and long term, ensure that we are using water and planning our water management system within the context of a changing climate. So these flagships build on the work that is already underway and aims to scale up this work. Honourable Chief, with the question around the submission of the plans. Honourable Whip. Committee Whip, Public Committee. The submission of plans, industry will be required to submit their plans shortly before we start with the system on the 1st of January 2016. So the work is ongoing in engaging with industry around setting of the allocations, setting of the common budgets, and once that has been agreed, and we have, and that would be something that has to go through cabinet because it's broadly it's a regulatory approach and it's a regulatory instrument that would be required. Industry would then submit their plans as to how they are going to reduce their emissions to keep within their budget allocation. We have not, to be honest, we have not finalized exactly what the time frames would be, but we would need to have an indication from industry up front of what their plans would be, but that would need to be developed in greater detail so that the communication, if there's communication to government on how industry would meet that five-year allocation. In terms of a carbon tax, what happens if the carbon tax, and the question of whether carbon tax would come to fruition or not, yes, indeed, there is quite a different strands of political or support and non-support for the context. The context is a key instrument, but if the context does not go through, certainly I think it would undermine our ability or industry's ability to reduce emissions, but I think we do not necessarily have to be completely dependent on it. It would require us to go back to some extent, go back to the drawing board in terms of designing the overall emission reduction system.
I think the one question that Judy did not respond to related to the issue of whether the marginal cost curves are based on loss in revenue or the cost of putting the infrastructure, or both. I think the loss in revenue is not quite significant. It is more the cost of the infrastructure or a replacement. For instance, if you're talking about any warming device, I use the example of HCFCs, hydrochlorofluorocarbons, which are in the refrigerator. And that element that is having, that has got that cooling effect in the refrigerator, to replace that element, that is the cost that is being projected there. And where there is no cost, then it's just the same that you make. For instance, if you use LED lighting, in terms of that LED lighting, you measure the new industry, but your thing that you use it to get light. So we will still require companies to give us the ability to have lighting in the building, and that industry would have to, if we had an old industry that was lying on lead-based industry, now those industries must transition and have the new technology that would help us respond. So the cost then is for that replacement, in essence. And I don't know whether I'm overly simplifying it, but in essence, that's what it is meant for. And lastly, on road, I was giving also an example on road rage. Again, you move in front, you would use your road infrastructure. There's a cost to using road infrastructure right now, using flight. It is not just only about carbon intensity, but it is also about the cost of keeping your road network up to standard. And that saves you from use of the normal roads, but then move the goods through a rail. But your initial investment on that rail is the cost that we then talk in respect of what you need to then to transition or to mitigate greenhouse gases. Okay, so I think that was the only question that was not responded to.
Okay, we're about to conclude the business of the day. There's one presentation that is going to be briefly very green fund. But before that, there are two issues. One is that the members want to leave. We want to deal with the aspect of item number 5 before they leave, so there is sufficient condenser. But I've noted Honorable Makubela, Honorable Danda, and then Honorable Olamide. They want to make follow ups.
In fact, the regulations currently in every government, most of the policy changes, they go clusters, but we do have a direct engagement with those departments on key fuels and so on, particularly, so we're involved in that process.
Okay. Thank you,
Chairperson. No, I just want to clarify the issue of costs, especially dealing with the cost from the source. You will recall that we used to have the fuel here called the leaded fuel. We are now using unleaded fuel. But I'm a little bit worried that some of the motor cars are still not yet been converted to use catalytic converters, which would contribute more on cleaning our our emissions. I mean, our air. So what pressure is the government putting on our manufacturers locally? Because we manufacture catalytic converters for export. Whereas if we were to insist that each and every car, truck and so on has that, then we would create more jobs, and added to that we would be using our own titanium raw material production.
Yes, I think a lot of members, it's a tricky, in fact it would be good if the committee could have a joint sitting with the other key portfolio committees, the one of transport, the energy one, and the economic development and trade and industry. Because we input in those processes, but the enforcement is not done, the ask is done by those departments. For the main cars, already DTI has issued regulations for manufacturing green cars. But the question is, I mean, are they going to the complete phase of the others? I think there's a balance. As much as there is unleaded cars that are working on unleaded fuel in South Africa, but there are also those, but the question is, if it's a COVID ban, then we need to have those departments that are supposed to enforce. So it will be the same here. We are more a policy department that facilitates changes in other sectors, and especially in this area of climate change policy response. A joint sitting would assist a great deal. Thank you.
Are we finished on the agenda item, Chair? And you mentioned that there's going to be another presentation on the Green Fund, but that doesn't appear on the agenda, sir. Okay. Chair, honourable members, the Green Fund is an instrument to support the kind of scaling up that we were talking about earlier. Whether it's scaling up programs to reduce emissions, scaling up programs to adapt to the impacts of climate change, supporting local authority work, practical programs. But this fund has been established by the department. I think it's important that we just contextualize it within the broader thrust around green economy and sustainable development. And the fact that there's a series of policy frameworks that guide our sustainable development and green economy work. There's the 30-year vision in the National Development Plan, there's the 10-year vision in the new growth path, there's the 5-year vision strategy in the National Strategy for Sustainable Development. It's about pulling all of these together to provide the clear policy direction and policy thrust. The green economy strategy has eight pillars are set out. I've added this slide, it's not in your presentation. I added it because I think it's useful to try and pull all of the elements of the green economy work together. So for example, we were speaking about green buildings and the built environment, that's one of the pillars. The sustainable transport and infrastructure is a second pillar. The clean energy and energy efficiency, third pillar. Resource conservation and management, the sustainable waste management practices, agriculture, food production and forestry, water management, sustainable consumption and production, and then there's various cross-cutting themes such as research awareness training. So this is the framework that pulls together the flagship program work that I I referred to earlier, pulls together some of the work that is being done under the environment programs, the Working for Water, Working on Fire, etc., under the resource conservation management work. It pulls together the waste management that Mark Gordon was presenting, and creates the basis for our broad green economy work. This is in the presentation, and it's a list of the relevant national policy frameworks that are applicable to the green economy work that is being done across national departments, provinces, and local authorities. So we're operating in quite a complex policy framework and policy space, but yes, it is clear, it is also clearly defined by the green economy strategy and the 8 pillars. Then we come to the Green Fund and its project portfolio. As I mentioned, the Green Fund is a key financing instrument to support practical work on the ground. The next just couple of slides give you a sense of the number of projects and the total approximate rand value. 45 total projects, approximate rand value of 725 million so far. The thematic windows are green city, low carbon, and environment and natural resource management. That's both of the three thematic windows are green city to low carbon, and then environment and natural resource management. There you can see the total a breakdown in terms of the number of jobs that are anticipated through the implementation of the program, the number of research and policy development projects, and the number of capacity building initiatives. I'm not going to go through the numbers. The numbers are there in front of you. There's a breakdown again. I'll just quickly run through. I'm not going to touch the numbers, but there you can see a breakdown in terms of the province, the number of projects, the total amount, and the job created and anticipation in each case. This one refers not to the project implementation, but actually to the Green Fund that is supporting research and development work. Rather than being actual implementation, this is research work that would ultimately support the implementation. Again, the number of projects and the rand value. This is the number of capacity building initiatives, the portfolio again in relation to projects, and the Green Fund investment project portfolio approval and disbursement by province. The last two slides refer to the progress on the solar water heater project, the project of particular interest and particular energy. It gives you the objectives, the activities, the target and the outcomes, and the total expenditure. It's a very quick run through, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can I get your indulgence, members? Honourable Adebe, Honourable Whip, Makubele, Honourable Olomisa, in the order.
Thanks so much, Chair. I noted to the concern there are three projects which were supposed to be in Gauteng, Mozulu Natal and Western Cape, which according to the document were cancelled and withdrawn. Can we get clarity why we withdrawn and cancelled? Thank you, Chair.
Chair, just two quick ones. The first is that when you go through all the slides, Limpopo does not feature. Probably the very for that, or it's not part of South Africa in terms of this. But the last one, on page 3, the slide about, well, the mobile features on the slide that is not yet, the very last slide that you have shown us, if that is correct. No, no, not this one. It's not there. No, but the very last slide, which is not part of the presentation, okay. It's feature.
On the one that you,
no, the very last almost. It is not necessarily featured on the one that we have answered the question. On the third page on the presentation that we have got, in terms of the initiatives for capacity building, it's only national housing and defense. Why is that? Because it's a pilot. What constraints are there not to ensure that it's a national wide kind of capacity building? So maybe to move with it.
role of Mr. and Honorable Standard?
Chairperson, I think we should commend the department for having started this fund. I remember we made this noise after COP17, wherein we said we cannot all depend on the Global Fund to address our environmental challenges. So we need to establish our own. And I think we should insist that the entire taxes, which are true from, for instance, from motor car taxes, new cars, you pay tax, that money should be ring-fenced in order to address all these challenges. And I would even further ask those who will be going to Lima that these statistics could also be used to boost the position of South Africa to say this is what we have done since COP17 in order to address these challenges.
Thanks, Honorable Sana.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just looking at the two slides on page 2 and 3, respectively. It's probably slide 3 and 6. Now, the jobs created, projected versus actual, and I'm looking at the approval and disbursement. Now, I see that some provinces or some projects have almost spent their full budget, but have barely even created half of the projected jobs. So I just wanted to see whether the projected job creation will actually meet the figures as indicated on page 2 or slide 3, and whether, because for example I see the Eastern Cape has still got a full balance of 34 million, but they've already created 180 jobs without spending any money, which is incredible. I wish you could do more of that. But then you look at the KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng projects that has already spent half of its budget. Well, they're kind of half on track, but I'm just concerned predicted jobs, actual jobs versus disbursements. It's a little concerning.
Question on the one posed by Honorable Mabuvela. There are two provinces that are not mentioned, Limpopo and Northern Cape. It will be proper that you also touch that so they should start it. Yeah. Thanks. Over to you, DG and DG.
I think this fund in before today, honourable members, the fund is run by the GDSA. The way education, so projects when you have public calls, and unfortunately the provinces that are not represented have not made the cut in respect of those projects. So, but we had asked the GDSA to look, because that's why we asked them to present the province, so they can also update us on whether in future there are initiatives that are coming from those provinces. Mostly projects are coming from cities, that's why you see more some Western Cape, Gauteng, because you have Tshwane, you have the city of Johannesburg, Ekurhuleni. In my question, both in terms of innovating on building, street lighting and all of that. So part of those initiatives reflect then the kind of proposals that were considered by the DBSA. Secondly, the other matter on the cancellation, if there are conditions that were assigned to the approval of the project, if any of those applicants do not meet those conditions, including part of the recoverability, there is a recoverable part of the fund, because they're also looking at how to sustain the fund into a future. So some of those which have recoverable components which we cannot meet, so some of those initiatives then would be cancelled. I do remember two cities, City of Cape Town and City of Johannesburg, said that after meeting, I think their councils, whatever reason, did not approve
and then to meet one of those requirements, and they then requested cancellations. And then on the numbers, there on the jobs, I think we have to double check. I don't know whether Judy has the answer. I'm not sure myself. So I would rather verify those numbers. Thank you very much.
Acceptable, Judy, that you present the actual state of affairs. So we, as a company level, the people who come, I think we'll be comfortable to wait for the actual state. Judy, for the DG is covered so that I close my meeting. Our meeting, not a meeting, sorry. Portfolio committee. You are covered. Okay. Is it a follow-up, Honorable Khaled?
Yes, sir. I think maybe in that response or in that explanation, I think they will also outline how this money then was spent. If the projects were handled and withdrawn, and how this money was spent. Like you see how it was spent because it was spent. Western Cape as well as the Kwazulu Natal. So I think that report should cover that as well, so that you can see where the money went to.
We can definitely cover that, members. It is not all, the full amount is not for one project, it's a number of projects. So one of which did not go ahead. So we can then get the details on those projects that amount to the 40 million rands and get the full explanation for the honourable members. Thank you.
Thank you, Gigi. Thank you, honourable members. We've come to the end of the portfolio committee. But we've got to deal with one aspect before we leave the meeting. Item 5, the validation of the chairperson, honourable Mthembu Mpumalanga. There's already a recommendation by the portfolio committee in the last meeting. It's not a secret, it's transparency, you can remain. We are not discussing any secrets here. Everything is above board, nothing is confidential. We are proposing that members who are interested to go, we intend to go this coming Friday. It's the only time we have. And also that the member must liaise with the secretary of the committee, whether they will be able to use the dozens or something. We must not plan and pass for this. If they can use their team, their own, it's voluntary. If members want to use their ticket, so be it. But we are saying those who are interested must communicate with the Chineka. The last one is just that the oversight person. Members will be notified accordingly. But the secretary has already done the necessary logistics between 4 to 28. On behalf of the portfolio committee, I want to take this opportunity to extend our sincere thanks and gratitude for all the members who graced the association, who are consistent, for your participation and holding the department to account. But also, DG, on behalf of the department, we want to thank you and your team that you are always available to come and make necessary presentations and to account to the portfolio committee. I know colleagues are of the view that we must not praise the fish for swimming because it is its role to swim. But we are deeply encouraged by the expertise that we have, the in-house expertise by the department to be able to rise to the occasion, especially if we have received this presentation for Lima. It clearly shows that we are up to the game, especially around the mitigation and the climate change aspect. So, DG, keep up the hard work. We appreciate the work that is done by the department, but we'll remain robust as a portfolio committee. No favors. We'll continue to ask the department to account. But our view is that we always give credit where it's due. This is a department that is working and we appreciate that. Thank you very much, including the members of the staff, officials. We want to thank you for everything. The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much. That lunch organized. Thank you.
Thank you for